This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Many bills are facing deadlines at the Capitol, or they're already dead. Two lawmakers are stepping down, leaving room for a new top Republican in the House and maybe a Kennedy. Red Sox Nation faces a difficult story about one of its favorite sons. And as Connecticut debates Common Core state standards, Indiana has already pulled the plug. Today's The Wheelhouse. It's our weekly news roundtable. And joining us to talk about this and other stories is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is also here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hello, Paz.
Good morning.
And Christine Stewart is the editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Good morning, John.
And you can join us, as always, at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email us wherelive at wnpr.org. You can always follow us on Twitter at Where We Live, and we've got a conversation about today's show always happening at WNPR.org. So the legislature adjourns 6 weeks from today, but we're already getting a sense of what bills will make it through the system. Several committees have deadlines for their legislation. Some things have happened. Some things haven't happened. I guess one of the things we've been talking about the most, Paz, is the minimum wage bill. This is something that, if passed, would make Connecticut at least in the forefront of President Obama's push to get to a $10 and 10-cent minimum wage.
Yeah, it looks like it would be the first state to get it on the books. Of course, it wouldn't take effect until January 2017. But yes, this is part of really a campaign strategy of the Democrats nationally. It's in part, it's an effort to change the subject from that pesky Obamacare. But it's a pocketbook issue that, you know, if you look at the New York Times today, you'll see a national story about this issue coming up across the country. It's an issue that Governor Malloy startled some of us by embracing it so enthusiastically in February and put on the agenda something that really wasn't expected to come up this year.
Colin, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit. Should we be surprised at all that Connecticut, being one of the richest states in the nation, and Governor Malloy's newfound embrace, as Paz has said, of this ideal, that Connecticut would be on the forefront of this very important issue for the president?
I don't think it's that surprising. I mean, for all of the reasons that Paz just cited, I mean, and I think we can be. Well, first of all, one thing I'd like to say is I still don't have any numbers that I trust. Maybe you do, about how many people in Connecticut actually earn minimum wage right now. Does anybody have a number that they believe?
The number that they give out is between 70,000 and 90,000.
Yeah.
And then there's a secondary number. By 2017, how many people actually would benefit? And that's over 100,000. But yeah, these are based on various projections, some census data, but some of it is numbers ginned up by groups that have a dog in the fight.
So, I mean, that's a fair amount of people.
And, absolutely.
And I do think it will make – I mean, we did a whole show with them, with people on minimum wage calling in and in the studio. It will make a difference. It'll make us – it's still not enough to live in Connecticut. In other words, you take it and you project it out, and for the most part, they're not getting to work 40 hours a week anyway. And maybe that's the other thing that ought to be yoked up to this somehow, the fact that for the most part, because of Obamacare and other things, there's a disincentive to employ minimum wage workers – a full work week. So they're doubly penalized. I mean, they don't make enough money per hour and they don't get enough hours. And to me, that second part is almost a bigger problem.
And I was just going to say that this is not a living wage. So in Connecticut, you know, somebody who makes minimum wage right now and works 40 hours a week is $18,000 a year. So it's not enough to raise a family on.
Another one of the bills that we've been spending an awful lot of time on is so-called aid in dying legislation. Some people call it assisted suicide legislation. It won't get voted on this session, Christine, right?
It will not. The Public Health Committee has decided not to vote on the bill this year. So this is the second year in a row that the bill will have died at the committee level. But the conversation has kind of changed. People are beginning to understand this issue is what, you know, supporters of the bill say. So there's still opposition out there. It's an election year. It's a tough issue. It's a personal issue. So it's not going to come up.
And this is one of those things, Paz, that has come up before. And it's on this cycle that seems to be understood at the legislature. The rest of us don't get that it is brought up at some point. Then a couple of years later, it has a push like this and it doesn't quite get through. But does it look to you as though this is something that in the next years, maybe the next non-election year, Connecticut might look at?
Hard to say. At the beginning of the session, the lobbyist for this really, you know, I asked her what the deal was, because you try to do triage at the beginning of the session as to what you're going to actually spend your time on. And they weren't terribly excited. They viewed it, I think, as a issue building year. But then you saw some of these other states embrace the issue or at least consider it. And there was a sense of a little bit of momentum. So there was some hope, I think, for a while that perhaps it would break out of committee. And once something like this gets to the floor, it becomes unpredictable because these are not the bills, by and large, that the leadership puts its stamp on and tries to steer. These are things that people come to for many different reasons, for many different places. So ultimately this year, as you know, Christine noted, it has not progressed in the sense of making it to the floor. There is that intangible sense that, yeah, the conversation did get a little bit further this year.
I actually think that one of the things that makes this issue difficult, it makes it difficult for me. I am not at peace about this issue at all. And one of the things that makes it difficult is ordinarily with a bill like this, one of the things we might ask, or with an issue like this, one of the things we might ask is, what if somebody really irresponsible and dangerous got a hold of this and used it the wrong way? Here, I think we have the advantage of having somebody already do that. His name was Jack Kevorkian. He was irresponsible. I mean, some of the people who died by his hand or with his assistance were people who were not in the late stages of anything. One of his first, maybe his first one, was a woman in her 50s in the very early stages of Alzheimer's disease. She was very depressed about the fact that she had Alzheimer's disease. She might, a year or two later, have felt differently about her Alzheimer's disease and had some good years and had some access to various kinds of therapy. There's nothing perfect, but there are things that can improve somebody's lot. So you've got to write a bill somehow or other that doesn't create an opening for the Jack Kevorkians of the future. You've got to write a bill in which people aren't taken advantage of or just precipitously pushed over the edge at a moment when they're depressed and hopeless and in fact, maybe do have good years ahead of them. I mean, I realize a lot of the people who fall under the rubric of this bill are not in that category. They're really at the end.
The common theme to this bill on both sides was fear. The people who wanted this law, there was this palpable fear of control of the end of their lives. On the other side, you had members of the disabled community, folks who, some of whom, it was clear, have felt they have been in a fight their whole life to retain control. And there was a suspicion, a gut feeling that maybe somehow a law like this would be pushed, would be used to sort of push them away somehow. And those, that's what struck me the day of the public hearing. You had that very strong emotion from opposite directions, from opposite sides.
I think what people also forget is that they tried to do this through the court system and they failed to do this through the court system because they were looking to make sure that doctors weren't prosecuted for giving these lethal doses of medication to the terminally ill.
We're talking about some of the legislation that either has a chance at the state capitol or legislation that is not moving forward this year, maybe to come back to life at some point in the future. Here on The Wheelhouse, it's our weekly news roundtable on where we live. You can join us as always at 860-275-7266. Of course, we've spent many, many weeks talking about the results of this year-long task force looking at freedom of information versus the public's right to know. Where do we stand right now with the potentials for FOI changes, Christine?
Well, there's two bills. There's one in the Government and Administration and Elections Committee and one in the Judiciary Committee. And the one in the Government Administration and Elections Committee, that's a mouthful, they modified and they took out the 911 recordings from. So 911 recordings as they are now would still be accessible under the FOI law.
And this is one of the things that that we've been sort of talking about an awful lot, Colin. I mean, it looks as though it's moving in a slightly different direction than it was maybe a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and maybe a slightly better. I mean, what it's not moving towards is getting the old FOI law back, which is what a lot of us think that A, should happen, and B, we should have had a better chance to bargain for. But at least with some of these modifications, it'll be a lesser of multiple evils.
Do you have any sense of what actually comes out of this at the end pass?
The stripped-down bill in GAE was a relief to some of the FOI proponents, certainly. But to Colin's point, it's the easiest thing is to kill a bill. It's not to get one going. Mm-hmm. So the idea of trying to regain the FOI rights that were lost, I think, may be a long shot. I have a much better feeling that nothing more harmful will occur this year, in part because the Senate President Pro Tem, who controls the Senate agenda, has made it clear he does not want to see a further erosion of freedom of information.
But what's interesting is that Senator Eric Coleman is the head of the Judiciary Committee, and he was on this task force.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's he would like to see some changes.
Amongst the other things we want to get to before we run low on time in this section of our conversation, we mentioned that there was a bill that would regulate the decibel levels in movie theaters. The Public Safety Committee turned a deaf ear and did not pass this.
They did. They turned a deaf ear and they did not pass it.
I didn't really expect this to happen, but you know, we spent some time on it, right?
Yeah. No. There was a constituent that somebody had in Stamford who was concerned about this, and the Motion Picture Association of America wanted nothing to do with it.
Well, and maybe we'll be talking a little bit about
this,
the motion.
This is Chris Dodd's home state.
The heavy hand of Chris Dodd.
We're going to be talking again about this later on in the program, actually. We're going to be talking about Chris Dodd coming up in just a little bit. We're also going to be talking about an implementation delay for the Common Core State Standards. Later on in the program, we'll be talking about how Connecticut is handling this and also how the state of Indiana is handling Common Core. But I want to get to Keno again. I can't believe we're still talking about Keno. There's a piece of legislation that actually deals with Keno and deals with our friends at CTN, the Connecticut Network. We're on CTN right now. I'll wave to the camera. Hold it. How do these two things get wedged together, Paz?
Only in the world of the Connecticut General Assembly do they get wedged together.
Okay.
There's a bill that became a vehicle to do a couple different things. And, you know, some of CTN's fans have, you know, said, look, these guys have not – this is a state-supported indirectly. There's some cable money that's intercepted. But it really comes down to state money in my humble view. And it's time to upgrade some of their equipment. There's a proposal to expand it. It has become, I think, not just because there are cameras on my face right now, it has become, I think, a very important part of public life in Connecticut.
Mostly because of that, though, frankly, Paz, we have to say. It's
yes,
mostly because of
mostly.
You. But anyway, please continue.
Well, these people here are so nice. And then the Keno piece, again, this has been declared dead really since the start of the session. And John Fonfara, the Senate Finance Chair, yesterday said, well, maybe we should try to save it and designate the money for municipal aid. And by the way, the only way that you were going to build support for Keno would have been to do that at the beginning. But because Keno was just tucked into the budget last year, there never was an open campaign for it. And the way so there's never been an open constituency for it.
But this is – so before we get back to CTN, Colin, but this is very interesting. I mean, this seems like sort of a goofy thing. But indeed, if you get the towns and cities all of a sudden now clamoring for Keno money, this is a reality maybe for
that
some towns.
That would create a constituency.
It sure would.
Just one point about this, you know, before we get to the end of this conversation. You know, we're talking about sort of the bills that aren't going to pass or are going to pass. And you look at it and it looks like it's going to be kind of an unimpressive session. And it's a short session. They can't do that much anyway, and I don't think they are going to do very much, except that who knows? Who the freak knows what they're going to do with 12 to 18 hours left to go in the session? I mean, it looks like they're not going to do that much, but one of the things that we've learned is they may have all kinds of things they're thinking about doing. They're just not going to tell us until they're good and ready, and that's going to be with less than 24 hours left in the session.
Well, and I just had Don Williams, the outgoing Senate president, talking about this amongst other things and about, for instance, the FOI legislation that passed at the 11th hour last time around. And he said, you know, we wish we didn't have to do things and we wish it hadn't have worked that way, but it did. I mean, Colin, we can keep talking about it, but we're going to continue to see, I think, this move toward legislation that happens at the 11th hour, that happens perhaps without any sort of public comment. We don't really find out until maybe months later.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I've had many, many conversations and arguments with these people because they do insist it's the only way they can do it, and it's just simply not the case. It's very convenient to do that way, and it's very convenient to shove all kinds of crap into budget implementers, you know, that are just unreviewable by anybody and get passed so fast. And I think until the citizenry, talk about creating a constituency, when the citizenry finally gets mad about this, something will change. But I don't think the average person knows about it or cares about it.
They've decided that the penalty they pay is too minimal. You know, we will write stories that will point out what was done in the middle of the night, and we always point out what time they passed it, and it was in the dark of night. And it's over some pretty crucial things and often some very complicated things, such as how campaign finance laws work.
Mm-hmm.
And these are and they will always say, well, the different pieces of it at different times was subjected to a public hearing. But that's not the same at what was ultimately put together. So yes, you know, there is a certain vibe and energy to a legislative session. Yes, deadlines are necessary to finally force people to the table. But there are bills that leadership could certainly take control of, as they have done with the minimum wage. And they've decided they're going to do this, you know, on a nice day in March when it's not going to get caught up in the machinations at the end of the session. And they're going to get it out of the way.
I didn't know there was a nice vibe at the state capitol. It sort of sounds like a dance club kind of.
I wish that there were consequences. I wish that there were, you know, it doesn't matter how many stories we write about this stuff, that it's not going to – they're not fazed by it. They're going to do vampire legislation.
Well, I'll say this. Right now we're talking not only in WNPR, which I know a lot of legislators listen to, but we're also on CTN, the Connecticut Network. Just quickly before we move on from this, in this piece of legislation, we're talking about a move – to more than double the state appropriation for CTN, the Connecticut Network. I mean, this would add new employees. This would essentially, you know, our friend Ken Dixon wrote, this would add to a kind of a propaganda arm for the state legislature. They like having their pictures on television, Colin.
Yeah, well, Ken suggested that perhaps certain debates go longer than they need to or than they used to, both in committees and on the floor, because it's very easy to talk legislators into the idea that they should be on television even more. I have to say, I enjoy Real Housewives of the Program Review and Investigations Committee a lot. And the new primetime show, That's So Sharky, I hear is really funny.
We'll see whether or not CTN brings their cameras back next week for the Wheelhouse. But today we're in the Wheelhouse and we're talking
right
about –
right now on the screen it says technical difficulties.
Before we move on, we want to talk about a state lawmaker who's stepping down. A handful of retirements announced in the state Senate, including Senator Ed Meyer of Guilford. He served in the Senate since 2004 in the New York Assembly before that. His career in public service started when Robert F. Kennedy appointed him federal prosecutor in 1964. And Meyer is hoping that Kennedy's nephew, Ted Kennedy Jr., will succeed him. So let's talk a little bit about this. First of all, Christine, for people who don't know Ed Meyer, tell us a little bit about Ed Meyer and what it is he did in the Senate and the possibilities for a Kennedy replacement here.
Ed Meyer is an interesting guy. I mean, he was a Republican when he was in New York, and he's a Democrat as he's gotten older. And
a pretty liberal Democrat.
He is a pretty liberal Democrat. He's 80 years old, and he is an environmentalist. And he's not shy about doing things. there was this Republican filibuster at one time, and he decided to take a cell phone call from his wife in the middle of the Senate circle. And it was Senator Duff, who was on the dais at the time, who had to call him out of order. And he said, "No, you're out of order." And then it ended up being an "and justice for all" moment. But it was he is quite a character.
And so passed?
Well, Ed Meyer is the single biggest beneficiary in the legislature of the resignation of John Rowland. Ed Meyer was the only guy in 2004 who ran on really one issue, and that was his opponent's relationship and undying love and support of John Rowland. You know, Bill Anaskovich was a guy who was teed up really in the eyes of some Republicans to be the next gubernatorial contender. He was one of, I think, four senators who declined to call for Rowland's resignation. And Bill had the misfortune of seeing the nonprofit he worked for do better and better with each year of the Rowland administration as far as state funding. And just as Rowland was losing his support in the legislature, Bill's wife was hired by Rowland for a $110,000 a year job, which Bill admitted looked horrible. And Ed ran on it with the help of a couple of guys from CCAG, our old friends Tom Swan and John Murphy. And it really was quite a story. I mean, it was one of the – as a political reporter for The Current, I mean, that was a state Senate race I went down and spent some time at because it had some, you know, bigger questions and bigger issues there.
And so, Colin, the possibilities of a replacement from the Kennedy family?
I think – I don't know. I'll bow to the other people on the panel. I think this is possibly a real thing.
Definitely it's a real thing.
And I don't know. I had some contact with Ted Kennedy. I actually like him. He was the victim. Oh, victim's the wrong word. There was a profile of him in the New York Times Magazine written by Mark Leibovich right at the time that Mark was sort of getting ready to promote This Town. And so he kind of got caught, I think, in that style of journalism. And it wasn't a good profile. It sort of had eerie echoes of his father's famous Roger Mudd interview. You know, it kind of sounded like he wanted to get involved in public life, but he didn't know how. But I think it was kind of unfair to him. And I actually do think he'd be an interesting candidate.
It was a little unfair. I mean, for people who haven't read it, I mean, it really showed in a kind of a humorous way about how Ted Jr. was being handled and that they were rolling him out like he was a new GM vehicle. Mm-hmm. And they were preparing him for the national stage or some stage. It was unclear. And it was unnecessary. I mean, Ted Kennedy Jr., unlike, you know, his brother who ran for office when he was a kid or some of his cousins who have run in their 20s when, quite frankly, their only attribute was the Kennedy name. You know, Ted Kennedy Jr. came to Connecticut and he's built a life. He's 52 years old. In some ways, his wife, Kiki, is better known in political circles because she's a big environmental activist. She's a psychologist.
She helped us sink this Broadwater deal.
Absolutely.
Gas terminal in the central.
A pipeline fight. So he's behaved in a very adult way. He's waited until his children were 16 and 20 or 19. But going back to 2010, I've had four conversations with him about what he hopes to do, and he kept talking about when the time is right. So he did not need to have one of his father's handlers sit down with him three times with a magazine writer from the New York Times. If ultimately all he was thinking about doing was taking a crack at the Connecticut General Assembly, we roll a little bit less formally up here. And, I don't think that was necessary.
But it's still all very important to us. That's why we're talking about it in the Wheelhouse today. Our guests are Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Christine Stewart from CT News Junkie, and our very own Colin McEnroe. When we come back, we'll be joined by Hearst, Connecticut political reporter Neil Vigdor. Over the weekend, he wrote a report on shadow lobbying. We'll be talking about that and more. You can join us at 860-275-7266 here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, and we're joined as always by Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on today's show, Colin?
This is a program about the ocean, ranging from the sort of the weirdest things that are in the ocean to, if you've seen the movies Captain Phillips or even the movie All Is Lost with Robert Redford, those enormous cargo ships that ship 90% of everything. We'll have the author of a book called 90% of Everything, which is most of the things that wind up here for you to buy and own come on one of these massive things.
It's interesting because watching the news of this missing plane, we've been just trying to grapple with how big the ocean is. It's a much bigger place than we think about it.
It's very big, yeah. As Rinker Buck said on our show on Monday, I mean, most planes that go into the ocean are not found or are not found for a really long time.
That's a really interesting show coming up at 1 o'clock with Colin McEnroe today. Mark Pazniokas is here, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. And Christine Stewart is editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. We want to bring in on the phone here Neil Vigdor, who's a political reporter for the Hearst Connecticut newspapers. Neil wrote a piece over the weekend about shadow lobbying. From his story, watchdogs say that a gaping loophole in disclosure rules has fostered a culture of shadow lobbying with scores of influence peddlers spending vast and unreported sums to advance their cause without ever registering with the federal government as lobbyists. Neil, welcome back to our show. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me back.
So who are you writing about here? Who are you talking about? Who's the shadow lobbyists?
Well, I thought it would be fascinating to take a look at. We've heard about this kind of culture of shadow lobbying from various watchdog groups in Washington. And if you take a look at over the last several years, the number of registered lobbyists has precipitously declined. And from everything that I've been told, the way that the regulations and disclosure rules are written, a lot of people don't technically, by the letter of the law, meet the definition of what's considered a lobbyist. So I thought it would be really fascinating to take a look and see, you know, Connecticut's most profitable companies, various economic sectors, you know, what kind of lobbying activity do they have going on? You know, watchdogs, a lot of them point to, while it's not a Connecticut-based industry, the Motion Picture Association of America, led by former Senator Chris Dodd, They point to him as kind of the poster child of this shadow lobbying culture. He is not registered as a federal lobbyist. And the rules kind of stipulate that you have to spend about 20% of your time making contact with members of Congress, certain people in the executive branch, congressional aides, to be designated as a lobbyist. And if you don't initiate the contact and a member of Congress actually reaches out to you, that's not considered a contact. So Senator Dodd has been, you know, leading the MPAA. They spent $2.1 million in 2013 on lobbying, and yet he's not registered as a lobbyist. And he was paid $3.3 million as the head of the MPAA in 2012.
Well, so Colin, first of all, let's just talk this through a little bit. If Chris Dodd isn't a lobbyist, then I'm not exactly sure what a lobbyist is. But should we be surprised by any of the stuff that Neil is saying, Colin?
Not terribly surprised. And this has been around for a long time. This is, I guess, the second time in the show we will say the name John Roland, coming out of Congress, John Roland. I mean, actually, the name we should say is Jeff Foxworthy, because I think you could do a sort of, you might be a shadow lobbyist if... You know? Well, if you have a job for which you have no other qualifications other than your ability to influence government and specifically legislation. So, I mean, that was sort of the question with Roland. You're doing what for defense companies? What are you doing? What could you be doing except lobbying? You don't know how to do anything else for them. You don't have any other expertise. And I think you can apply this to a lot of these situations. If the former member of Congress is working for somebody for whom he has no expertise to contribute – other than his ability to sway legislation, then he's probably a shadow lobbyist.
Can we all just have a moment of silence and enjoy the fact that Colin McEnroe just quoted Jeff Foxworthy?
It had to happen eventually.
Yeah. Okay.
Mean, Paz, very, very quickly, though, I mean, as we talk through this, we're not supposed to be surprised. But as Neil's piece kind of points out here, we probably should be paying closer attention as we look at the big companies that he's got in his story and all the millions that they're paying for actual lobbying. We can only assume that there's this much more money going into non-lobbying activities that are really exactly that.
These stories are hard to get excited about unless they touch an issue and show how the money, how the relationships moved something. I mean, this is a good overview of how it works, but, you know, let's face it, the public and even elements of the press is not going to get that excited unless you can show that, aha, this relationship and that relationship led to a line inserted in a tax bill, which is going to mean billions of dollars for a certain segment of the economy.
But Neil, isn't that exactly what they're paying all this money for, to make sure that those connections are never actually made, that we never see that line that's actually drawn into a bill, that we just sort of gloss it all over and it ends up in legislation anyway?
Sure. I think that the silence kind of speaks volumes. You know, it reached out to all of these companies, the vast majority. You know, did not want to discuss their lobbying activities. You know, one of the even Senator Blumenthal, who is usually, you know, loquacious and happy to comment, he did comment for this story. But I was discussing with him his interaction with lobbyists from Disney, which is obviously the parent of ESPN. They lobbied his staff on legislation that he introduced that would effectively end the antitrust exemption for the NFL if the NFL doesn't back off its blackout policy. And Senator Blumenthal, I asked him if it would be possible to get the communications from Disney lobbyists to members of his staff, and he said he was uncomfortable with that. So I think it's kind of an understanding, you know, that kind of the interactions between these lobbyists and people who work on the Hill, you know, that there's a certain amount of confidentiality to what goes on behind the scenes.
We're talking about Washington, of course, and influence. Christine, I assume that this is a big part of what happens every day at the state capitol as well. There are a lot of people who are constantly lobbying, either as official lobbyists or people who have an awful lot of influence who really aren't registered to be part of that world.
Yeah, and the Office of State Ethics will crack down on some of these people if they do believe believe that it, the threshold, I believe, is $2,000. So if you spend, you know, if you're lobbying and your expenses exceed $2,000, then you have to have a badge and you have to display it prominently.
If, quickly before we move on from this, Colin, is there a way to get people more excited about this issue, to get people more interested in the fact that this is really the way money tends to flow and influence tends to flow in Washington and Hartford and all the other state capitals?
You know, that's a really great question, and I wish I had a tremendously glib answer to it. I don't, other than to say what alarm – you know, I've been watching the show House of Cards, and I've been trying to figure out why people like House of Cards, why has it become so popular. And I think it's because – people think this is sort of the way things are, you know. I mean, I think they have very low expectations for Washington, and they like seeing it sort of played out in front of their eyes and on a fictionalized basis, seeing things that they suspect are the case anyway. Now, in fact, none of the people we've talked about so far has pushed anybody in front of a subway train or caused anybody's death by I can't even say it by suffocation in a garage with a car running, to the best of our knowledge.
But, spoiler alert! Yeah. Jeez.
Well, I didn't say
that was
who.
The first season.
Yeah, it's the first season. You know, but I actually think people think this. People think it anyway. They think the worst already. So it's very difficult to get them excited about how bad things are.
We're going to slide over slightly before we let Neil go and just talk a little bit more about money and politics. And I just want to make sure we understand something a little bit better. We keep talking about how Governor Daniel Malloy has yet to announce his reelection plans, but he's essentially already deep into campaign mode. How much does fundraising and the way that money flows right now to state political campaigns have to do with this delay in becoming an official candidate pass? How does this work exactly?
The answer to that question 4 years ago was crystal clear, that there was an obvious advantage in holding off the formal declaration of candidacy, because you could use an exploratory committee to raise, in the case of Governor Malloy, $500,000 to be ready to go before you got the public financing. This time around, the answer to that question is a little fuzzier. Now, part of the answer is Governor Malloy does not need to announce. He does not want to spend the public financing grant really until the summer and into the fall. There's another political aspect of he wants to be seen as governor. So when you get to the nitty-gritty, I've asked this question of election lawyers, and I have not gotten a clearance saying, yes, aha, this is the big advantage he gets under state campaign finance laws by not declaring. Michael Brandy, the general counsel of the Elections Enforcement Commission, told me, he says, I don't really see one. In a vaguer way, once you are a candidate, there is a added scrutiny that the Republicans could apply to him and suggest that there are certain things should go on the account of his campaign committee. But again, we've already discussed about how basically the public doesn't follow, nor does it much care about, you know, the ins and outs. So I'm sorry, I don't have a crystal clear answer for you saying, aha, this is the absolute reason why.
Well, once he announces, everything he does is going to be viewed through this political lens. And so everything he does gubernatorially as governing isn't going to be viewed just as him governing. It's going
but it's
to be
not
viewed.
It's not now. This is
no, it's yeah. not. Right. I would agree that it's not now.
The
but
minimum wage, like we're not viewing
I know.
It through
no,
the
No, I know.
Well, and I think that that's the thing. He says he doesn't want to be viewed, but people view it however they want to view it.
Yeah, there's a kind of a myopia here. I mean, I think people at the state capitol actually think this distinction is meaningful, whereas most people perceive politicians as politicians. They don't think, oh, that guy isn't a politician because he hasn't declared his candidacy for re-election. This is a distinction that is completely lost on everybody, you know, outside a 50-yard perimeter of the state capitol. So I don't think it's that meaningful. I don't know. But I do think Christine has a point that once you – it's sort of back to Neil's article. Once you register, so to speak, once yeah. you register, you just have to file a lot more stuff. You're just – you know, a lot more open to inspection. And I don't know what the status of this is. Maybe you guys do. But there was this Republican in Newington who filed a complaint with the SEEC claiming that there is a campaign going already and they're just not reporting it. An argument that I don't find tenuous at all, actually. I don't know
That's going to probably be resolved in the next month or so. I mean, they took it seriously. They're investigating it. There was one related complaint that was just dismissed. It was a complaint filed against the governor. But the whole question of the quote-unquote shadow campaign, again, that's not, as you would expect for something has the word shadow in it, that's not crystal clear, because you can do a lot of coordination with a state party.
Well, but before we let Neil Vigdor go, you know, shadow campaigns, shadow lobbyists, Neil, it's already been a suggestion in our conversation here that this stuff matters in and around the halls of the Capitol in Washington or the halls of the Capitol in Hartford. Doesn't really matter to the general public. Do you think that's true?
I think I would agree that with that to a large extent. You know, I think that the timing of Governor Molloy announcing his reelection, I think, has less to do about money and more to do about the conversation and you know, how long he'll have to play defense for as the incumbent. And you know, basically, I would think that the Democrats would you know, want him to announce in May, you know, shortly before the state party convention, and the Republicans will have their state party convention, and you could have a contentious GOP primary campaign going on over the summer that could take some of the spotlight away from Governor Molloy and his record. And then, you know, ultimately, after the August primary, that's when things will ramp up. Mm-hmm. So he's really condensing the time frame in which he has to play defense as the incumbent.
Neil Vigdor is political reporter for the Hearst, Connecticut newspapers. We've got links on our website, WNPR.org, to his story about shadow lobbying over the weekend. Neil, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John. Have a great day. Thanks, everyone.
But before we move on quickly, we're going to get another announcement probably today about somebody stepping down. Larry Caffaro, the House minority leader, has been saying for some time that he's going to not seek re-election. He wasn't going to seek the governor's job. Now it seems as though he's going to announce that he's not seeking re-election. A big surprise here, Paz?
Not a surprise at all. Yeah. There have been people running for minority leader for months with Larry's consent. From the moment Larry announced last year he wasn't running for governor, I think everybody at the Capitol assumed that would be it. It was up or it was out.
Christine?
No, I agree that it's not a surprise. I mean, it's just – it was a matter of announcing. He was going to announce in January, and then he was going to announce in February, and now we're at the end of March. And in between that time, I think he was delayed in announcing due to the FBI investigation.
Well, and the death of –
he was all set to do
this 2 weeks ago. I mean, it was – they had set aside the time, and then State Rep. Yeah. Elaine O'Brien died, and Larry decided it would be inappropriate to make that day about him. This is the next session day since then, so guess what? He's doing it. But this isn't going to be like us hearing that Dawn Williams isn't running again, where it was like, wow, that's unexpected. That's a big change. This is – you know, this is going to be Larry's moment in the sun, and they, you know, that's what they do up there. They have a little – they'll have tributes while they're waiting for the minimum wage bill to come downstairs.
I mean, I think the end of the Larry Caffaro era, you know, it's sort of a double-edged thing. I mean, on the one hand, I think everybody would agree he's one of the most amusing, affable, genial, entertaining legislators to serve in our lifetimes. And it's hard not to like Larry. On the other hand, Larry works for Brown Rudnick, which is one of the two or three or maybe one or two most influential lobbying firms in the state of Connecticut. I've never quite understood how you can work for a lobbying firm and participate in legislation that the lobbying firm is involved
in. He says he's not lobbying. He says that that's not part of his job.
It doesn't really matter, though. You ultimately, you know, you wind up, you are part of a lobbying firm. This is the what we call the appearance of conflict of interest.
In the perfect balance that is the Connecticut General Assembly, at one point, the House Minority Leader was employed by a law firm that had a major lobbying practice, and the House Majority Leader was employed by a public sector labor union.
Yeah.
You know, but no, Larry's employment. You know, the tangential, you know, splash of mud that landed on him last year as a result of the Donovan thing, that made him less viable to run for governor. I don't think any of that stuff is pushing him out of the legislature, but I think it did. Larry denies it, but I think it's hard to believe it did not play a role in his decision not to run for governor.
And we just glossed it over quickly, but there was this investigation by the FBI at the state capitol as well, Christine.
Yeah, subpoenas were issued, and they named Larry Caffaro's chief of staff, George Gallo, who resigned after the subpoenas came out regarding the direct mail services.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got a lot more to get to. We're going to talk about Common Core state standards here in the state, what we're doing with it. And we're also going to talk to a reporter from Indiana about how Indiana dropped the Common Core. We're also going to get to a story that a lot of people in Red Sox Nation aren't all that happy about. That's coming up right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to listen back to a conversation we held with teachers from around the state. We asked them what their jobs are like, how those jobs have changed, how we can improve education, and how education reforms are affecting them in the classroom. That's a story that we're going to cover once again tomorrow here on Where We Live. I hope that you can join us. Now, we're going to listen to that tomorrow, but since that first aired earlier this month, Governor Malloy announced a Common Core Task Force, which met for the first time yesterday. Now, last month, Education Commissioner Stephen Pryor was on our show. At that point, Malloy and Pryor had proposed a slowdown of teacher evaluations and some of the implementations of the Common Core. I asked Pryor about what had changed between when these had been proposed and when they decided to slow things down.
We rolled it out together in accordance with a plan that we discussed through PEAK. And we all decided together that listening, especially to teachers and to educators throughout the state, including superintendents, we had some revisions to make. I'm proud of that.
But teachers were, of course, very vocal about these education reforms all the way from the start. Let me bring into the conversation Kevin Basmajian, who's dean of the School of Education at Quinnipiac University. I know that you've been talking about this, Kevin. Welcome to the program. Do you think that this task force is a good idea this far along in this process?
Thank you, John, for having me on the show. Yeah, I mean, it's a good idea, but I think it really would have been something to think about a couple of years, 18 months ago, to think about the rollout. There was a lot of time that went into the development of the standards that did involve teachers, but I think that there was, it almost seems as though the state was caught off guard in terms of the actual implementation and the rollout now.
So, you know, the thing that I asked both the governor and Commissioner Pryor about, the fact is the teachers have been very vocal about this. A lot of education advocates have been vocal about this all along. Do you think that the United States, all the states, including Indiana, the one that we're going to talk about in just a moment, moved too quickly into adopting these Common Core state standards?
Well, I think there was – I think there's separation here. One is the standards themselves, and I think there was you know, it's 2010 is when really the discussions really began in earnest, and they've been developed over the past, you know, several years. So, and there was a lot of buy-in, and I think you can look at the standards, and I think there are some value to the standards. They do raise the bar in many areas. I think there are some questions about the developmental appropriateness of the standards. I think there's some questions about what's left out of the standards around social emotional kinds of things, around the arts. But so I think the timeline for development of the standards, you could maybe say that could have been extended, but certainly where we are now with the challenges we're facing in the rollout, this is something that I think we could have done a better job of thinking about and putting this task force in place a year ago to think about how do we make sure to evenly implement these new assessments across our state of Connecticut.
Now, stand by for one moment because I want to turn to the state of Indiana. Governor Mike Pence signed a repeal of Common Core. Indiana is the first state to do so. 45 states have signed on for this. Indiana, the first one to drop this idea so quickly. Scott Elliott is bureau chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. And Scott, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the political motivations, if you know them, behind Indiana deciding to adopt these Common Core state standards that are very controversial and then drop them kind of in the middle of a school year here.
It was really fascinating and a very fast role reversal. Indiana was an early champion of Common Core. Mitch Daniels was the governor here. Tony Bennett was the state superintendent. Both of them were very strong Common Core supporters and were actually involved in sort of promoting the standards to other states. Daniels left office, and Bennett was defeated for re-election, and Mike Pence came in. And Pence, I don't think, really had a terribly strong feelings about it, but he's more conservative than Mitch Daniels. He voted against No Child Left Behind when he was in Congress because he thought it was federal overreach. And so very quickly, the Republicans who were open to that sort of idea or that point of view that maybe this was too much involvement from the federal government got on board with, like, slowing this down and ultimately going the other way.
So what's the impact for teachers there in Indiana? You get started moving toward one thing, and then you get told you're going to have new standards written by the state coming up later. I assume you're hearing from teachers that this is throwing a lot of chaos into the classroom.
There's a lot of questions about how to change course so quickly. We're still in the middle of developing what are going to be the new Indiana state standards. There are some draft standards out there. There is a lot of overlap with Common Core, that's one thing that's still being fought over is whether it should have as much overlap with Common Core as it does. But they do want to get these new standards in place by the fall, and some people are wondering whether that's even realistic.
Kevin Basmajian, just quickly, I want to turn back to you on this. You teach teachers. Obviously, this idea of throwing into chaos what exactly they're supposed to be doing, how they're going to be evaluated. You see it happening here in Indiana. Do you see that there's some worry that this could happen here in Connecticut?
I don't think so. I think we're moving forward with the standards. I think the implementation, the rollout, will be interesting to see how it goes, and it gets a little bit delayed. But I think generally, there's certainly not everybody's on board, but there's general consensus in a lot of communities around the Common Core that on a pragmatic level, it makes sense to have a sort of set standard, and it doesn't mean we can't exceed that standard. A standard that from state to state, that we know what skills and knowledge, but particularly the skills, are going to be assessed at different grade levels. And I think what it sounds like has happened in Indiana is that there was almost, it was a little bit more of a principled or political sort of view that the federal government should not get involved. I think the state may be looking more pragmatically that, look, let's make this happen with the teachers. Now, what has happened, I think I've been in a lot of schools, and teachers have spent a lot of time over the past couple of years really changing their classrooms over to think about the new Common Core State Standards. So it's going to be challenging, I think, for Indiana to now reverse course, even though on the sort of principle that the federal government shouldn't get involved. I think many teachers are saying, okay, we can work with this. There's a lot of flexibility in these standards.
Kevin Basmajian is Dean of the School of Education at Quinnipiac University. Thank you very much for your time. I also want to thank Scott Elliott, who's Bureau Chief of Chalkbeat, Indiana. Thanks for the reporting, Scott. I appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Before we finish out the program very quickly, and in this slowdown in the state legislature, what exactly happened with this? The Common Core State Standards, I know, came up for a vote in committee, Christine?
No, actually. They had a public hearing. So the Republicans pushed through a parliamentary rule to be able to get this bill, which is the moratorium on the Common Core Standards, to a public hearing. The Education Committee has adjourned and has not passed that bill out of the committee.
So it's not been passed out of the committee.
The task force seemed very jolly yesterday about Common Core. My prediction is you're going to hear a little bit of pushback about who's on this task force.
Which was appointed by Malloy.
Yeah, because it seems like everybody's going, wow, we got Common Core in the library. We got Common Core dodgeball here. What's the problem? Common Core is easy. I'm thinking, boy, that doesn't sound like what I've been hearing for the last 6 months.
If there is Common Core dodgeball, it would be much more popular. Yeah. Look, Colin, we just have 2 minutes left for something that I know we wanted to spend more time on, and maybe we will have to on a future program here. We usually end on kind of an upbeat note on the show, but we both took a look at a story over the weekend about Jared Remy. This is the son of Jerry Remy, the beloved Boston Red Sox broadcaster. He's in the Boston Globe. We're going to link through to it on WNPR.org. You're a big Red Sox fan. Paz is a big Red Sox fan. What did this article say to you?
It basically described the arc of a young man whose propensity for violence started at the age of 19 and then just continued for decades. And the court system just kept punting him back out into the public, he was just dismissed on continuances over and over again. And after a while, until he eventually stabbed somebody to death, after a while you start to wonder if his name was Jared Smith, if he had no connection to Red Sox Nation, would this case have proceeded the same way? There are just a million different questions and a million questions. Even the Red Sox, who at a point where he was, I think, a danger to the community, made him a security guard, which seems paradoxical to me.
Well, briefly, and of course, they fired him. Mm. But yeah, it was a very disturbing story. Unfortunately, it's not an altogether unfamiliar story if you take out Jerry Remy's name. He may have been assisted by his father's fame, but more basically, he may have been assisted by the fact he had well-connected lawyers. He could afford the best legal talent, and in almost every court system in America, on stuff that does not really jump into the spotlight, that still counts for something.
But beyond all this, there's this sense that there's a conversation about Jerry Remy and the Red Sox being enablers here, that essentially they either watched or they actually helped this young man along this path of destruction.
Yeah, and you know, look, first of all, my heart goes out to the Remy family, and any parent who's ever, you know, dealt with a troubled kid has sort of wondered, at what point do I cut the kid dead? What kid point do I stop helping? Parents, your natural inclination is to help. It does seem that at a certain point, this went too far. It went too far on behalf of Jared.
There were two opposite moments in that story. One is that Jerry Remy himself called the police when his son was a teenager because he thought his son's behavior was inappropriate with a girl, that he had seen her push a girl, and he brought it to the attention of police. So that was when the kid was a teenager. Then you fast forward to all the times that he provided help So you got to wrestle with that.
It's a very sad story for Red Sox Nation. Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe from WNPR, and Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. Thanks for your help in the wheelhouse today. This is Where We Live.